This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Imagine you've grown up with an embarrassing speech impediment that makes you terrified of public speaking, and you suddenly become an important world leader who has to address the public. That's the fate that befell King George VI of England, who came to the throne in 1936 after his brother King Edward abdicated to marry an American divorcee. After years of speech therapy, King George gave this radio address in 1939, when Hitler had invaded Poland and England had declared war on Germany.
For the second time in the lives of most of us, we are at war. Over and over again, we have tried to find a peaceful way out of the differences between ourselves and those who are now our enemies. But it has been in vain.
King George's long relationship with his unconventional speech therapist is the subject of the new film, The King's Speech, directed by our guest, Tom Hooper. Colin Firth plays the king in the film. The Australian-born speech therapist is played by Geoffrey Rush. Tom Hooper won an Emmy for directing the HBO miniseries Elizabeth I, starring Helen Mirren. He also directed the miniseries John Adams. Among his other films are Longford and The Damned United. Well, Tom Hooper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Dave.
This film, The King's Speech, this is one of these films where we don't have to worry about giving away the story. I mean, it's fairly straightforward. It's about this very close relationship between the king, George VI, and his unorthodox speech therapist. And there's a fascinating backstory of how the screenwriter, David Seidler, developed the story. Tell us where his interest came from and how he pursued it.
Well, the story of how this film was made really begins in the Second World War with a small boy who had a terrible stammer. And this little boy used to listen to King George VI on the radio and think, if the King of England can cope with a stammer, maybe there's hope for me. And that little boy is our screenwriter, David Seidler. King George VI was David's childhood hero, his inspiration, his guiding light. And when he grew up and became a writer, he long dreamed of writing about King George VI. So he started to research this and got some blips on the radar of one Lionel Logue, a speech therapist to the king, of which there was very little information about. But he managed to track down Valentine Logue, who features in our movie, who's the son of Lionel Logue. And Valentine revealed that there were in his attic a handwritten diary account of the speech therapist, his father's relationship with the king. But he said, before I show it to you, you need to get permission from the palace. So they wrote to the palace, and the queen mother wrote back to David and said, yes, but please not in my lifetime. The memories of these events are still too painful.
King George VI, of course, led his nation during World War II and was an important inspirational figure for his people and had to give all these speeches on the radio. And it's interesting that he was confronted with this challenge of conquering his stutter in some respects because of technology, right? I mean, 30 years before or after, he wouldn't have had such an issue, would he?
No, I mean, what's extraordinary about the whole drama of this story, it derives from the advent of this new medium, this new mass communication medium called radio. Because before the advent of radio, a king was a visual icon. I mean, as long as he could wave from a carriage, look good on a horse, look good in uniform, he could perform the theatrical duty of being a king, which was principally, I would say, in terms of mass iconography, visual. And with the coming of radio, suddenly a king was required to speak, to connect, and therefore to be effectively an actor. So you have this guy, who's the younger brother who has no expectation of being king. You know, his older brother gives up the throne to marry the American Wallace Simpson. He has a terrible stammer and becomes king right at the moment when this medium has taken off. And, his audience is not just in England. Britain still has 58 countries in the empire, so it's a vast, emergent global audience. And he can't speak. And even more ironically, it's that, 10, 15-year window when it was only a live medium. I mean, you could not pre-record, you could not edit So you couldn't cheat the Stammers out. It had to be a live performance.
When he gave these wartime speeches, was this speech therapist Lionel Logue in the room with him? Was the only one in the room?
Yeah, I mean that's what we can tell from the diaries is that, you know, Lionel Logue was in the room one on one with the King for I think pretty much all the wartime speeches. And one of the things that's so, you know, the other great thing about the diaries is it reveals what lies behind, you know, famous imagery. So, for example, it was my birthday recently, and my sister gave me a copy of The Times from the 4th of September 1939, so the day after war's been declared. Now, it being England, and we're an understated nation, news of the outbreak of the Second World War made page 8 of The Times. And on page 8, there's a big half-page picture of King George VI in his full naval uniform at this grand, ornate desk, with these ornate microphones his father used in a very grand and gilt room, giving the speech that we see at the end of our movie, which is basically the speech he made when war was declared. But we know from the diaries that this is not true. He made it in a special room that Logue set up, which he decorated to make it look cheerful, with an old school desk that Logue had rescued from the basement of Buckingham Palace, you know, which he'd hammered wooden stilts on to raise it up, and the King did it standing up with his jacket off, with the window open, with Logue in the room, one-on-one. And so I now know that image, that famous image of him giving the speech, is complete nonsense. It's a fabrication. It's a piece of propaganda. And that's what what's so lovely about the diaries is not only did it give us some flavour of their dialogue and their relationship, but it also, you know, gave me these wonderful physical clues with which to get behind, the surface of the monarch at that time.
So the world knew that King George VI struggled with the speech impediment, but knew that he had managed to overcome that and give these speeches. And what this story really tells us now, it sort of unmasks this close collaborator, this man Lionel Logue, the speech therapist. Tell us just a little bit about him.
Well, he was older than the King, and he was kind of someone, you know, who grew up, you know, basically being fascinated by the voice. So he was born in Adelaide, but moved early in his life to Perth, where he married.
He's Australian.
In Perth, yeah. He's Australian. Yeah. In Perth, he taught elocution in schools. He recited Shakespeare and Dickens. He acted a little bit. I think he taught drama. And when the First World War came, there was this sudden influx of young men returning from the Western Front with speech problems, with post-traumatic stress disorder, with shell shock. And they literally kind of said, Lionel, you're the local guy who knows about speech, so why don't you have a crack at helping these poor young men? And that's what he did. And he basically taught himself through trial and error speech therapy in Perth and developed techniques in order to help these men. And, you know, the script, our film suggests that what he felt was these young men, you know, had lost faith in their voice, and he was giving them the right to be heard again, you know, to talk about their trauma and to find their voice again. And he went to England, I think it was 1923 or 24. And he went because, I think on the encouragement of his wife, because he felt that, you know, London was probably where it was at in terms of speech therapy, and so, you know, he should go and find out more about it. And I think they went not intending to live there, but they ended up staying, and he ended up setting up a practice in Harley Street and landing the biggest client of his life.
Right, and of course it's actually King George's wife, who's played in the film by Helena Bonham Carter, who comes and visits Lionel Logue. One of the things that you see in his methods is that he believes it's not a matter simply of mechanics, that there is a psychological basis for this, and he invades the King's royal privacy by asking questions about what happened to him in his childhood. What do we know about the origins of King George's stutter?
What we know is that he had a very tough childhood. I mean, his parents were very absent. I mean, it's worth pointing out that children of that class, you know, aristocratic children, the norm was you would be brought down at tea time every day and prayed in front of your parents for half an hour, and that was kind of the relationship as a very young kid. You're mothered by nannies. But the nanny, you know, who he had very early on in life, was absolutely in love with David, his older brother, and didn't like him. I mean, not only didn't like him, but neglected him and, you know, didn't feed him enough and caused him, you know, stomach problems, which led to, you know, being an ulcer, him having ulcers and being invalided out of the army during the First World War. So, I mean, what I know about stammering, and a lot of this comes from David, the writer who had this stammer, was that when as a young child you lose the confidence that anyone wants to listen to you. You know, so you've got parents who aren't interested and you've got a nanny who loves your older brother and isn't interested, you lose confidence in your voice and you lose confidence in the right to speak. And a lot of the therapy is about saying you have a right to be heard and people should bloody well listen.
Well, that's the story. Let's talk about bringing it to life on film. And I thought we'd listen to a clip here. The King is played by Colin Firth, and the speech therapist Lionel Logue is played by Jeffrey Rush. And this is a moment where they've been working together for some period of time. George the Sixth is now about to be crowned king, and this is a moment where they have cleared out Westminster Abbey so that they can rehearse, and this king can confront the task of making a few remarks upon the occasion of his coronation. And they get into an argument, and I'll just mention it makes it easier for the clip if we note that there's a point at which the therapist, Logue, has the effrontery to park his seat in the chair where monarchs sit, and we'll hear that. And what really begins the argument is the king is frustrated and fearful and angry about this situation, and he also has discovered that Lionel Logue is not a doctor and is essentially self-taught. Let's listen.
No training, no diploma, no qualifications. A great deal of nerve.
Lock me in the tower.
I would, if I could.
On what charge?
Fraud. With war looming, you've saddled this nation with a voiceless king. You've destroyed the happiness of my family, all for the sake of ensnaring a star patient you couldn't possibly hope to assist. It'll be like mad King George III. I'll be Mad King George the Stammerer, who let his people down so badly in their hour of need. What are you doing? Get up! You can't sit there! Get up!
Why not? It's a chair.
No, that is not a chair. That is St. Edward's chair.
People have carved their names on it.
Chair is the seat on which every king in
your
life...
I don't care how many royal arseholes have sat.
Listen to me!
Chair.
Listen to me!
Listen to you by what right?
By divine right, if you must. I'm your king.
No, you're not. You told me so yourself. You said you didn't want it. Why should I waste my time listening to
because
you?
I have a right to be, and I have a voice!
Yes, you do.
And that's Jeffrey Rush and Colin Firth from The King's Speech, directed by our guest, Tom Hooper. You could hear Colin Firth and his playing a royal with a stutter. He has to get this just right. He can't overdo it. Tell us about developing his character.
Well, I think the inspiration for his performance for both of us was the real king. And we found this wonderful bit of archive footage on the Pathé news site, which I think is available on their public site. From the
one in
Glasgow,
yeah.
Empire Exhibition, 1938. And, you know, try as the newsreel people can to cut away from Bertie. So they cut from his close-up to, you know, spectators in the crowd. They cut to fluttering flags. They cut to chimney pots rather randomly. Whenever they come back in this profile close-up to the king, you just can see in his eyes this longing. He just wants to get it right. That's all he wants to achieve. And he keeps getting caught in these horrible, painful silences in which he drowns. And he stops himself and gathers himself and tries again and gets caught and drowns in silence. And it's so moving that by the end of this 3 or 4 minute clip, I had tears in my eyes, and Colin and I saw this and were both hugely moved. And I'm not sure how aware Colin is, but I think he's kind of in an extraordinary way bottled the essence of the real King's stammer. And to me, you know, what it's closest to is you know, if I think of all the references for stammering, we thought about, that's what it's closest to.
Yeah, you know, it struck me that a stammer is almost like a physical metaphor for someone who hesitates at taking on a duty that seems too daunting, like being a wartime monarch in the United Kingdom. And the other thing that struck me was that what was so powerful about the performances was not the sound so much as what he's doing in those awful silences when between the sounds when he's trying to get them out.
Yes, and I, you know, from what we understand about the mechanics of it, I mean, your throat really does lock up, and so there's if you're the stammerer, it doesn't, you know, the block, although it maybe starts psychologically, it ends up physical. I mean, there is no air passing in either direction down your throat when you're in mid-block, and so you're also, you know, lacking oxygen supply, just to add to the woes. And there's a couple of great profile shots in the film where you can see how much the musculature of Colin's neck is being sort of seizing up with this effort, and he actually started to complain of getting numbness in his left arm over the course of the shoot. Such was the physicality of playing this. But you know, what I think Colin understood brilliantly was that, a bit like, you know, if the best way to play a drunk is to concentrate on trying to be sober, the best way of playing a stammer is concentrate on trying to get out of the stammer rather than trying to get into the stammer. And I think Colin concentrated on the exit strategy and found the stammer through that.
I wanted to talk about John Adams, the HBO miniseries you directed, which got a lot of awards and drew a big audience. And it's interesting because, you know, you're bringing to life characters that Americans have idealized in a lot of ways, the founders. And I'm just wondering, as a filmmaker, when you have to bring to life Ben Franklin and John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, do you need them to make them in some way recognizable to us as these idealized figures, or do you want to humanize them, or is it some of both?
It's a very good question. I mean, I struggle to see any of these characters as anything other than human. I mean, King George VI, I've never had a problem thinking of him anything, you know. When people go, well, they're royal, how do you see them as human? I never struggle with that. I think in the case of John Adams, I think there was a certain freedom that I wasn't, by not being brought up in America and not being taught the idealized version of the founding fathers, where they were these impossibly mythic kind of superheroes on pedestals. Perhaps I was more able to approach them as real characters. I mean, I love, for example, this early thing I picked up from David McCullough's wonderful book that Thomas Jefferson just didn't speak in the Continental Congress. I mean, he was the silent one. He was the guy. He was the gnomic one who never contributed to debates, never opened his mouth, and said very little, which is so counterintuitive because we think of him as the great wordsmith because he's famous for the Declaration of Independence, and we also, you know, assume he is the, you know, a big iconic star. And of course, through McCullough's book and research, you learn that when the Continental Congress started, he was very much the junior partner in the room, particularly to John Adams. And so one of the reasons he didn't say very much is he was very junior and you know, in fact, was asked to write the Declaration of Independence partly because they, you know, John Adams thought it was too junior a task for him to do himself, and he was too busy with what he felt was the main event, which was winning the debate on the floor. And of course, you know, Mr. Adams didn't realize, you know, the kind of status that document would have got. Otherwise, I'm sure he would have written it himself in retrospect. But you know, it's those kind of weigh-ins which immediately, you know, what's great about, say, that detail about Jefferson is because the general public don't know it, you're immediately sort of wrong-footed because you're kind of going, oh, that's Jefferson, how intriguing. I didn't know he was so quiet. And in that moment of realizing that you don't know a story that you thought you knew, suddenly the storytelling can become vividly present tense, because you're no longer navigating it through people's existing cliches. You basically bust through them right at the beginning with the way you've introduced the characters. And it's terribly exciting when you do that for audiences because they basically start connecting in a completely different way.
You know, I read that you shot the American scenes, particularly the scenes during the Revolution, differently than those in Europe, such as when Adams was in Paris in England.
Yes, I chose to shoot the American material quite roughly. I mean, it was almost exclusively handheld cameras. It was quite a lot of Dutch tilts where the camera is off the level, you know, so it's down on the left or down on the right. And more than that, there was often no consistency in the Dutch tilt. So I'd be cutting, you know, shots that were slightly off balance with shots that were on balance. And I was interested to doing this because I was desperate to capture this sense that the story in front of your eyes was the creation of America was relentlessly provisional. You know, that because the hardest thing to do as a director, when we're all sitting in America and American independence is a fact, is to create any sense that American independence was not a foregone conclusion and actually as a project when it started was supremely unlikely to be achieved. I mean, in fact, you know, when the war started, it wasn't even a war. It wasn't a war about independence. It was a war about redressing rights. And the notion of independence came quite late and was so radical that it was so radical because it seemed so unlikely that it could be achieved.
So the handheld cameras and the odd angles kind of remind us that this was a risky and very uncertain undertaking on the American side. Europe was different, right?
Yeah, and with Europe, I reverted to classical filmmaking where the camera's dolly mounted and, you know, the shots are level and the language of the filmmaking is classical. There's lots of nice wide shots intercut with the close-ups, whereas actually I kind of avoid a lot of classical wide shots in America, so that you feel a sense of you're back in the traditional world, in the ossified world of rules and classic, you know, and classical governing structures like the monarchy that have been around for centuries.
I wanted to play a clip from the film, and it's one that's from the European part of it. And this is well into the story when John Adams, the revolution is over, America has gained its independence, and John Adams has been chosen as the first American ambassador to England. And after being in London for a while, he has been granted an audience with King George III.
Oh, great.
And he has been carefully instructed in the protocol that he is to enter the room, bow immediately, walk halfway to the throne, bow again, and as he approaches the throne, bow deeply again. And this is Adams humbly approaching the king, introducing himself, and then the king, King George, played by Tom Hollander, responds. Let's listen to it again. Adams speaking first.
The United States of America have appointed me minister plenipotentiary to Your Majesty. I think myself more fortunate than all of my fellow citizens in having the distinguishing honor to be the first to stand in Your Majesty's presence in a diplomatic character.
I will be very frank with you. I was the last to consent to separation. But the separation having been made and having become inevitable, I have always said, as I say now, that I would be the first to meet the friendship of the United States as an independent power. I pray, Mr. Adams, that the United States does not suffer unduly from its want of a monarchy.
Yes, we will strive to answer those prayers, Your Majesty.
And that's Paul Giamatti and Tom Hollander in John Adams, the miniseries directed by our guest director, Tom Hooper. This is such an affecting scene visually, too. Just tell us a little bit about how you envisioned this first encounter between the British monarch and the new independent America.
You know, it's kind of like John Adams meeting the Darth Vader of our story. I mean, you know, this is the English monarch. This has been the enemy since the beginning. I mean, the Declaration of Independence is a personal letter addressed to this monarch saying we've had enough. And, you know, he comes into this room and it's such a heavy process of preparation that by the time you get to the door, you know, anyone would be out of their head with nerves. And walks in and finds this slight, rather sort of unexpected man standing by his throne, rather dwarfed by the height of the throne, not sitting in it. And, you know, it's immediate. What I wanted to try and create was immediately that the sense of bathos, where how some human beings don't live up to their mythology, and King George III was a man who in person could not possibly be impressive as the machinery of monarchy would like to suggest he was. But then, having created that sense of sort of anticlimax for the viewer, I was intrigued that Adams was actually rather charmed and seduced by King George III. And when King George III says at the end, quite sincerely, "I hope that America doesn't suffer from the want of a monarchy," I wanted to set in motion in John's head this question mark about whether or not America would suffer from the want of the monarchy.
Well, you know, that scene was powerful to me in for a couple of reasons. One is you see John Adams coming in. It's his duty to represent his country and to establish a relationship with England, but he's clearly overawed by the scale of the room and the throne. It's impressive and intimidating to see. But the other thing that I found fascinating was Tom Hollander's portrayal of King George III, because there is this incredible stillness about him and a look which I could only describe as otherworldly and in his eyes. And it made me think this is somebody, a monarch who's grown up from birth believing he is different from all other human beings.
I have to say, I think it is an absolutely extraordinary performance from Tom Hollander. I mean, and what I particularly loved was Tom's decision. It was his idea, it was not my idea, that he would stand by the throne and not sit in it, so that when John Adams arrived, you expect to have the cliche image of a king sitting on a throne, and you don't get it. And Tom, I'm sure, being conscious of his height, because he's not a hugely tall man, knew that it was going to present an odd image because the throne was going to dwarf him.
Well, I wanted to talk just a bit about The Damned United, which is a film released last year, which I missed completely. I guess it had limited release in the States, but was just great, great fun. It's about a soccer coach in England of the 60s and 70s, or I guess a football manager, as he would be called.
Yeah.
Tell us just a little bit about the story and what got your interest.
Well, Brian Clough is the hero of this film, is the most iconic football manager, soccer manager, in English history. And he was an extraordinary, outspoken maverick who was the star who burnt incredibly brightly. And he was unusual in that he was so charismatic and popular that he crossed over into popular entertainment culture. And he was kind of the person who first rode the wave of when the complex matrix of sport, big finance and celebrity culture began to intersect to remake the game for the modern world. And my film is really a story of hubris. Our thesis in the film was that Brian Clough's success was really made possible through a great working partnership and friendship with his assistant manager, a man called Peter Taylor. But Clough, being a complete egomaniac, starts to believe or want to believe that his brilliance is all his own and cuts himself loose from Peter Taylor to take on managing this team called Leeds United, which was really his nemesis, you know, growing up.
Well, you know, I thought we should get a scene here where the main character, Brian Clough, who, as you said, is this rising star in soccer, has been chosen to coach at Leeds United. And he is played by Michael Sheen, who people will remember from – he played Tony Blair in the film The Queen. He also played David Frost in Frost Nixon. But this is a moment at which he's sitting down with the owners of the Leeds United club. And part of the story here is that he has an intense rivalry with a much more famous soccer coach named Don Revie, who had previously coached Leeds. And so in this moment, the new owners are unhappy about their new coach. And so we hear a little exchange. The owner, played by Henry Goodman, will speak first.
I hired you to do this job because I think you're the best young manager in this country.
Thank you. I'm the best old one, too.
I also did it under the assumption that you would be coming here wanting the best for this club, for the city of Leeds. So why do I get the feeling this is all about you and Don?
Of course, it's just about me and Don. Always has been. But
Instead of putting frowns on your foreheads or ye elders of Leeds in your blazers and your brass buttons, it should put big white Colgate smiles on your big white faces, because it means I won't eat and won't sleep until I've taken whatever that man's achieved and beaten it. Beaten it so I never have to hear the name Don Revy again. Beat it. It's the only name anyone sings in the Yorkshire alehouses, raising the stinking jaws to the stinking mouths, is Brian Clough. Brian Clough, Uber Alice. Understand?
And that is hubris indeed, isn't it? Michael Sheen playing Brian Clough in the film The Damned United, directed by our guest Tom Hooper. A lot of your films, of course, deal with history, John Adams and the current one, The King's Speech. And this is, in a way, a kind of a trip back to a different era of sport. I mean, these soccer stadiums are pretty decrepit and shabby. Is this something that you remember fondly had fun recreating?
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in putting on screen a kind of forgotten footballing Britain before this incredible influx of money, partly coming through, Murdoch's Sky Television, which bought up football rights and transformed it forever. Before it came in, when the football grounds were falling apart, and it was a working class game. It was not. It hadn't become gentrified. It hadn't become, celebrated by the middle classes, and the players made as little money as the fans.
I read that you, for the crowd shots, you used inflatable people among the ones. Is this true?
Yes. Not only that, the same inflatable people also feature in The King's Speech. And not only that, I had the bizarre experience of having filmed at Leeds United Ellen Road Stadium on The Damned United, filled with 2,000 dummies, who knew that only a year later I'd be back in the same stadium, Ellen Road, in Leeds, recreating Wembley Stadium in 1925 with Colin Firth with exactly the same 2,000 inflatable dummies for companionship.
And why that in a world of CGI and computerized graphics?
Because the cost of CGI is immense. I mean, we keep being told we live in this new world where this revolution's happened. The truth is the cost per shot of visual effects is beyond the kind of budgets of the films, I tend to make. I actually got the idea from Ron Howard, who I found out had used, I think, up to 40,000 of these dummies in scenes, and used them also in Frost Nixon in the dining scene. And the joy is that once you've paid for them, you can do any number of shots, and they fill out, the stadium in the background, and you don't need to worry. Whereas if you don't have them, every single time you see any part of the stadium, it becomes a visual effects shot. So it was one of the best decisions I took to invest in my 2,000 dummies.
So do you have a garage somewhere with thousands of deflated dummies?
They're not actually my own, you'll be pleased to hear. I'm pleased my psychology is in good shape in that respect.
Well, Tom Hooper, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Tom Hooper's new film is The King's Speech. When acclaimed biographer Hazel Rowley took a group tour of the historic Roosevelt home Hyde Park years ago, she was struck by the number of questions her guide had to field about the Roosevelts' marriage. On investigation, she was further struck by the fact that though there are thousands of books devoted to FDR and Eleanor separately, there was no one book specifically devoted to the married life they shared. Now there is. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Rowley's new book called Franklin and Eleanor, An Extraordinary Marriage.
One of the most amazing anecdotes in Hazel Rowley's crackling new biography of the Roosevelt marriage, called simply Franklin and Eleanor, has on the surface nothing to do with their personal relationship, yet it speaks volumes about the trust the first couple placed in each other. In November 1939, as the Red Scare was gathering force, the House Un-American Activities Committee subpoenaed members of a college student group called the American Youth Congress to testify about their organization's ties to the Communist Party. Getting wind of this event, Eleanor asked Franklin's permission to turn up unannounced at the hearing. He gave it, and the First Lady took off. At the noontime break, the students still hadn't been called to testify, so Eleanor invited them back to lunch at the White House. When she found out the students had nowhere to sleep that night, she invited all 10 of them to move into the White House, the people's house, after all, for the duration. That evening, the students, some of them poor, first-generation Americans, dined with the president and discussed HUAC as well as other breaking news, including the Soviet invasion of Finland. It's unimaginable now to think of a first lady or a president acting with that much autonomy. But what that anecdote also reveals is the enlightened disregard Franklin and Eleanor had for conventional categories. As Rowley vividly describes, throughout the latter two decades of their 40-year unorthodox marriage, the Roosevelts shared their private life at close quarters with an alternative family of aides, advisors, and close friends, most of whom were from working-class backgrounds. Both Franklin and Eleanor also gave each other space to cultivate romantic friendships outside of the marriage. Whether these relationships were physical or not is still up for debate, but the language of existing letters shows there's no question they were passionate. In Eleanor's case, those romantic friendships were with men, like her beloved bodyguard Earl Miller, as well as with women, like the journalist Lorena Hickok. It was no secret to her colleagues in the press corps that Hick, as she was called, was a lesbian. Nor was it a secret that she and Eleanor seemed to be deeply in love. A few months after FDR's first inauguration, Eleanor wrote to Hick about their open secret. "And so you think they gossip about us. I am always so much more optimistic than you are. I suppose because I care so little about what they say." By the way, Rowley can quote those fearless words because Lorena Hickok preserved almost all of the 3,500 letters she and Eleanor wrote to each other from 1932 until Eleanor's death. The Roosevelts' nonconformist love lives, as well as their expansive impulses to turn the White House into a World War II-era hippie crash pad, have been recounted by other superb biographers, notably Blanche Wieson Cook and Doris Kearns Goodwin. What distinguishes Rowley's chronicle is her focus on the evolution of the Roosevelt marriage from a standard-issue, high-society alliance of its day to a what? We don't even have a term for such an unconventional relationship. Certainly, open marriage sounds too naughty, although open is what the Roosevelts clearly became. Of course, they didn't transform their marriage out of mere happy whim. There was the harrowing tragedy of FDR's polio and his rehabilitation, which naturally forced the couple apart. During the late 1920s, Rowley points out that Franklin was away from home for 116 weeks. Eleanor was with him for 4 of those weeks. His secretary, Missy LeHand, was with him for 110. And then there were the failures, which loosened both the marital and family ties. FDR's affair with Lucy Mercer, Eleanor's rather strained style of parenting the couple's 6 children. Eleanor, an eternal daddy's girl, sadly confessed later in life that, "I do not think that I am a natural-born mother. If I ever wanted to mother anyone, it was my father." Rowley doesn't excuse these flaws, but traces how the hard times helped the couple achieve what she dubs one of the most interesting and radical marriages in history. Rowley has chronicled out-of-the-box relationships before. Her last book was a highly acclaimed biography of the partnership between Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. Nothing against the French, but there's no contest here. While Sartre and de Beauvoir were hashing over gender roles in sequestered cafes, Franklin and Eleanor had already forged their own cutting-edge version of a marriage, despite living for nearly 4 terms in the fishbowl of the White House.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Franklin and Eleanor, An Extraordinary Marriage by Hazel Rowley. You can read an excerpt at our website, freshair.npr.org. In the last two decades, New York bass player Scott Colley has backed jazz musicians including singer Carmen McRae, pianists Herbie Hancock and Fred Hirsch, saxophonists Chris Potter and David Binney, and drummers T.S. Monk and Antonio Sanchez. Colley also leads his own record dates. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Colley's new album has a strong sense of place, even if it's one he's never visited.
Scott Colley's new album is called Empire, named for a sod house Kansas hamlet where his ancestors settled after the Civil War. Not the Empire, Kansas, near Lake Canopolis, but a short-lived community near McPherson on the prairie, abandoned in the 1870s when the railroad passed it by. Scott Colley's not from those parts, but his music fits the wide-open flatlands where you can see the weather coming on. For extra rural twang, he's got Bill Frisell on bluesy, country, jazz guitar. Scott Colley's slow, singing bass there nods to his old teacher, Charlie Hayden, the Missouri bassist with a touch of the Ozarks in his sound. Colley's Empire is for various combinations of five musicians, including pianist Craig Taborn, known for rambunctious playing with James Carter, Tim Byrne, and Dave Douglas. In his solos here, Taborn catches the stillness of sparsely populated landscapes. He makes a few notes carry far. It's all in the touch and the timing and quiet support from Brian Blade's drums. This music's spine is made of wires and wood, the ringing tones of bass, piano, and guitar. The lone horn player is trumpeter Ralph Alessi, whose pealing sound lends Copeland-esque grandeur to the amber waves. He and Frisell stir things up a little, too, to make sure the music's not contemplative all the time. Scott Colley's lyrical, catchy tunes bring Empire halfway home, but it's the players who complete the job, who breathe life into the frameworks he builds. This is Heartland music, born in Manhattan. Not Manhattan, Kansas. The other one.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Empire, the new album by bassist Scott Colley, on the Cam Jazz label. You can follow us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.